and welcome back to another inspirational week of The Geek Whispers. I'm Amy Lewis.
I'm Matt Brender.
And I'm John Mark Troyer.
And this week, we have gathered a very, very special unicorn in our midst, Dave McCrory. Dave, could you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Dave McCrory. I'm currently the CTO of Basho Technologies. We make a distributed database.
Awesome. Now, the great irony of this podcast, for those of you who happen to know Dave or I personally, I know Dave best as the awesome guy who married my best friend. Ironically, I know not a whole lot about your professional journey, Dave, so I'm going to ask you all the questions that would be embarrassing to ask at a dinner party, but I don't mind asking it on a podcast.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the four of us. Let's just talk about it.
That's right. We'll keep it our little secret, right?
One of the things we wanted to have you on to talk about, I do know that you have had a very interesting career. You've done a lot of stuff. And one of the things that has always struck me is that you have a lot of leadership opportunities. You have led teams. You have done, again, all sorts of interesting things, individual contributor, leadership opportunities. And you aren't this person out shouting off the rooftops. When I think about geeks trying to find their way forward, sometimes I think people feel like they have to be the loudest person in the room to make it. So I'd love to hear your kind of personal development journey, how you got where you are.
Sure. I started out when my parents bought a computer and I was 8 and I wanted to play games on that computer. I don't even know if I had an Atari 2600 at the time, but I watched the guy from Sears Businessland. Yes, Sears used to sell computers. And he came and set up the computer and showed the family how it worked. You would load the floppy disk into the IBM original PC and load a game off of it. And in the process of loading it, you could see that it was written in some kind of language. And so I remember playing this game, and I remember losing at this game over and over again. And out of frustration, I said, there must be a way to give myself more lives playing this game. So I decided to look at that magic computer source code stuff. And lo and behold, after I don't know how long, probably a half hour or 45 minutes, I found the setting for the variable that would allow me to give myself a million lives. And that's what I did. I gave myself a million lives.
Oh, my God. This is the best story ever. I can't believe I have never heard this. You hacked a computer game. That's how you got started.
Well, you know, it was a motivational thing. So I started to do a little programming and such. Later on, years later, I would find out about bulletin boards and such, BBSs, as they used to be called before we had this internet thing that everybody uses now. And so I got into bulletin boards and I was into computers. And I believe it was my senior year of high school, I got a job at a computer store. I had always wondered how to build computers. And so I got a job where I learned how to build, at the time, what were clones, if everybody remembers the days of clones. So I was building clone PCs. And then I went off to college. I started off majoring in industrial technology. I was also into cars and such. I love to take things apart and put them back together, usually with a few spare parts left over. I ended up changing majors a couple of times. Then I switched schools. When I switched schools, I started to do consulting on the side. My first semester at the new school I was going to, the new university, I started to attend class less and less. And the reason was because I was getting these fantastic consulting opportunities where being in college in the 90s and charging $50 an hour to go work on computer systems, you know, fixing things and teaching people how to use them and all sorts of things was more lucrative, and I was doing pretty well. So I decided to get certified. I got certified at the time. The two main things that businesses were using, if you were talking about small to medium-sized businesses, were Novell and Microsoft. So I went and got certified as a Microsoft Certified Systems Engineer, MCSE, if you guys remember that. And I also got a Master CNE, the Certified Network Novell Engineer. While I was getting those certifications, I taught at a junior college. I taught basic computer stuff. And what I mean by that is I taught middle-aged people what a computer was and how to use it. And I literally mean this is a monitor. This thing in front of you is a keyboard.
I went through that with my dad as well. Since Geek Whisperers, we're here kind of at the intersection between kind of geeks and marketing and how in business and how people talk to each other and things like that, I want to underline a couple of things. So you were on the bulletin boards. I don't know how active you were on those. Sometimes those things are pretty addictive. You were doing consulting, so you had to have some customer service skills. You had to talk to people. You presumably had to do some selling or at least asking for money. And then you were also teaching. So it's not like you were stuck in your mom's basement on the bulletin board. You actually were starting already to be a geek who communicated.
I think that's fair. When I was a kid, my father was interested in marketing and several other things and had me take a Dale Carnegie course with him. So I had to do some speaking and such. I can't say that I was particularly excited or appreciative of that at the time. Being the only kid in, I think I was in seventh or eighth grade at the time, in a classroom full of adults taking a Dale Carnegie class wasn't exactly my idea of a fun night.
But that went really well, over really well with the seventh and eighth grade girls.
It went over great, let me tell you. It did let me talk my way out of a few fights, I guess. Maybe that was the positive.
Dave, I love the humble beginnings, right? Like that we all have this story that starts, I'd say, out of necessity as somebody that was inspired to pursue computer science purely because I liked hacking my games as well and was playing on a Game Genie when that came out and reprogramming things. I'm with you all the way that necessity creates that desire to learn how the tech works. And then also, like, you're just kind of following a combination of opportunity and necessity, right? That it became a big deal. When do you think you had a sort of breakout moment, or what was the first team you were on where that leadership path came out? Was that something you were seeking, or is it something that was just part of the opportunity?
I would like to pause on the answer to that question for about 3 minutes, and then I think I will answer it, if that's okay.
Of course.
Okay. And you'll see why I said that in a second. What I had done after I got those certifications was I got what I would call my first real full job at a big company. I went to work for, at the time, what was called, this is the longest name for a company I'm aware of, GE Capital IT Solutions. So GECITS. Yes, that's the abbreviation, and it takes a long time to say. General Electric Capital Information Technology Solutions. So it was a subdivision of GE and then a subdivision of that subdivision, just because it's not complicated enough. I went to work for them for, I guess, about 2 years. And then I left and went to work for what was called Sprint Paranet. Sprint Paranet was where Sprint had acquired a company called Paranet. When I was at GE, I worked in public sector and financial sector doing consulting work using the skills that I had gotten with my MCSE and MCNE. And then with Sprint, I was doing work in a Fortune 500 data center. And in the meantime of doing the consulting work, I had picked up some skills with Citrix, which I didn't think at the time were going to be very valuable, but it turned out they were incredibly valuable. So while I was doing that, I was sitting in this Fortune 500 data center. I had finished my project, which was deploying a worldwide Citrix implementation. And when I mean worldwide, I mean offices in Dubai, the Bahamas, all over the US, you name a place. There were countries all over the world. And so I was supporting this Citrix deployment, and I had spoken to the person that was in charge of contracting, dealing with all the consultants. And I said, I'm finished with my project. You know, I'm now sitting here. What else do you guys need me to do? And he said, well, that's what we want you to do. We want you to sit there. And if there are any problems, we want you to be right here ready to take care of it. And I said, that's great, but you realize you're paying me to just sit here and not do anything. And he said, yeah, isn't it great? And
that was your first real IT job, yeah.
Yeah, to many people, that's a career.
I wasn't that excited, believe it or not. So I was talking to one of the other guys there. This guy was on the help desk, and he said, you know, I've been thinking that Citrix stuff that you use, wouldn't it be cool if you could have a bunch of businesses share one Citrix install and they could like all share Office and other things using Citrix? And I started thinking about that, and I said, you know, I think that's a really good idea. And I decided that I was going to build a business around having these hosted Citrix implementations. And I pitched this business idea to the management at Sprint. They passed. And I decided that I was going to do a startup doing this. And I might add that this was in New Orleans, Louisiana, otherwise known as the Second Silicon Valley, in case the people were wondering.
Really?
Oh, yes. There's tons of technology there. Actually, it's pretty much a wasteland. But so,
right next to the drive-by daiquiri shops. Anyway, yeah.
Yes, that's right. So I started to try and create a business. And this is where the first lesson came in. I spent about 9 months trying to find people that would be interested in investing in me and helping me start this business off. And I wanted to be as secretive as I could and not tell anyone. The reason was that I didn't want anyone to take my idea. And after 9 months of not succeeding, I decided to start trying to bring in some people to be partners with me and to start sharing more of my ideas and thoughts and what have you. And so I did. I went to what was called the New Orleans Technology Council, and I went and met people there, and I started to go through the few people that I did know. And within about 3 to 6 months, we had a management team. We had raised money from friends and family. We had raised, I think $250,000 initially. That was kind of our seed round. And ultimately, in our full seed round, I think we raised like $125,000, something like that. And as time progressed, ultimately, we raised from venture capital another $5-something million. So we raised money. Those were a lot of hard lessons learned for me. But the first big lesson was that I couldn't go it alone, and I shouldn't be afraid to share my ideas with others. That's something that I've taken with me all the way up until today.
I think that's a big deal. People don't realize that when they're first starting off and often are secretive. It's a pretty common pattern. In fact, even just recently, a friend of mine in Chicago wanted me to look at his new business, and he wanted me to sign an NDA. I laughed at him, because in Silicon Valley, that's just really not done. It's just not worth it. No one really wants to steal your crappy idea. But I did it anyway. That's interesting. That's a very common pattern.
It is, and I certainly followed it to a T. Fast forward, the idea, which ultimately the category that we were in was called application service provider, that turned out to not be such a great idea. So in the quest to try and lower our costs and figure out a better approach for the business, that was part of where I started to learn leadership and management skills, in that you have to deal with people as people, and you deal with their performance on the job as something that is tied to the fact that they are a person. And if you treat them as people, they will show you a lot more loyalty if you show them empathy and if you show them respect. And you have to gain their trust. I made quite a few mistakes in my first startup early on because I didn't have that experience and I was learning on the fly. So you make mistakes, and I did. The handling HR issues, having to fire people ultimately because they weren't performing, those were all very difficult things. And it's still not easy to fire someone, but they were difficult, especially the first time you have to do it.
Just sort of curious, was social media sort of spun up as much as it is now, or were you able to kind of fail quietly in those ways? Do you feel like it would be a different thing? You know, everything's so public these days. What's your thought?
I think things are more public, but I think there are still mechanisms that companies use to make sure that things don't get out of hand. I mean, usually when you're leaving a startup, you end up signing something that says that you're not going to disparage the company when you leave. Usually that turns out to be in the best interest of both parties, because usually when people get upset, they say things that they wish they could take back later anyway.
Gotcha.
But this was actually in the 90s. This was early 2000s. I'm sorry. So at that time, by the way, that's when I ran across this tiny company in Palo Alto called VMware. If it was 100 people, that would have been incredibly large. This is when VMware was on Porter Drive. And I remember meeting with Diane Green in a room that is probably, I don't know, maybe 15 by 15 room, something like that, this tiny room, and there being a television-style monitor on a crash cart in this room. And I remember speaking to them and having lots of conversations. And then I remember installing ESX for the first time and having the realization come to me that virtualization was going to be something huge.
You're like, I think this is going to be big.
That was literally the realization I had. And I remember speaking to VMware and asking them how you would manage all these virtual machines. I remember having them tell me that it's going to be Perl scripts. Perl scripts is the way. And I remember just being blown away that somebody would think that you could manage thousands of virtual machines with Perl scripts.
One should not.
That's right.
One should not, yeah.
So the outcome of that was we pivoted the business, and we decided to get into the business of managing virtual machines. And so that's what we did. That was my company, ProTier. We became one of the first companies to manage virtual machines. And ultimately, that company got merged into another company, which was called Sergient. Sergient took over the customers and the software and the hosting business and everything else that we had built at ProTier. And that's also when I moved from New Orleans to Austin, where I stayed for 10 years in Austin. The things that I learned from that phase of my career, if you get a bad feeling in your gut about someone in management or someone that you're working for, you should go with the feel in your gut, and you should probably take a serious look at what you're doing or what you're about to do, and you may want to make a different choice. I ended up staying longer probably than I should have at Sergient because I didn't get along with the CEO. And in my career, I might add, that's probably the one big bridge that I intentionally burned. I do make it a practice to not burn bridges, to not say things that I would regret. I think that's the one time I burned a bridge, and I, to this day, think it was the best decision I could have made.
I've used it before, but I'll have to say it again. She cracks me up. She said that was advice someone had given her. Don't burn bridges, but if you do, bring the gas can. Like, don't hold back.
Nice. If you're going to commit to it, you commit to it. Absolutely.
Well, question here, just sort of jumping in. So all this stuff is going on sort of right at the beginning of the blog era. I mean, there's bulletin boards, there's other ways. Yes. Did you find yourself engaged in any of those kind of community activities? Were you really focused on the business? Like, where were you in that sort of part of your community development?
Awesome question. Awesome question. I was nowhere. That's where I was. Blogs were just starting out. A friend of mine, David Marshall, who I had kind of brought along with me all the way from when I was consulting at GE. He and I had remained friends, and we were in touch. Ultimately, I got him involved and brought him in at ProTier, and he came along and moved to Austin and was part of Sergient. And when he was part of Sergient, he decided to create a blog. That was where VMblog, if you guys remember or know of VMblog, that was the birth of VMblog.
And it's still there, and that's when I met Dave, and for a long time, he had a column in InfoWorld, and the blog was still going. He was early days when I was first searching out people, who on earth is blogging about this product that I can co-opt, that I can bring into the fold. He was one of the very few, and I think he was in the first rounds of the VExperts as well.
He was, and another person that I'm friends with now, Alessandro Perilli, was really the only other major blogger that I remember at the time with virtualization.info.
Yep. But you were not.
I was not. I was not in that scene at all. What I did see was a large number of the benefits and advantages that David was seeing because of that. But I went off. I left Sergient. I did 6 months of consulting as a virtualization expert for a grid computing company, which was United Devices. And then I did another startup, because I hadn't had enough punishment the first time.
In terms of hats that you're wearing, are you thinking of yourself as a technologist, as a businessman, as an entrepreneur, or as kind of a technologist slash entrepreneur? I imagine the latter. I'm just kind of curious where your head was those days.
I saw myself as a technologist slash an inventor, really, okay. is what I saw. I was inventing solutions and novel things to solve problems. During that time, while I was at Sergient, I had filed several patents, of which several were granted. Sadly, I won't ever see any money from that because they're all assigned to what is now Dell, because I should add that Sergient was ultimately acquired by Quest Software, and then Quest was ultimately acquired by Dell. So all of the intellectual property that was owned by all of those companies is now owned by Dell. And I also wrote a book with David Marshall and another guy, Wade Reynolds, called Advanced Server Virtualization. I would say that's the closest to blogging or getting my name out there that I did, was my involvement in writing the book. But it really hadn't caught on for me. I'm kind of a slow learner sometimes.
It sounds like you were a little busy too, underachiever that you are.
Well, I was busy, but, you know, it still didn't really occur to me. I still really didn't know what to make of it, and I didn't know if I'd be able to write or not a blog or something like that.
How did you connect with peers? I'm totally curious. I have no idea, because I assume you were, especially like after you wrote the book, did you go on the tour circuit a little bit for it? Did you do events, go to VMUGs? How did you just in general connect with colleagues?
I connected with colleagues on a very slow basis. I went to a few VMUGs. I did meet a fair number of executives and such. And I went to VMworld, and I met several people at VMworld. And then I met people through David Marshall. But I really didn't meet all that many people. And I was still tied to the local Austin community. And that was kind of the limit of scope of what I had. I started this second company, which started off as InnovaWave but became Hyper9. And when I started that company, it was focused entirely on software. I could code a little, but by no means did I consider myself a hardcore developer, not even close. But I wanted to build some amazing software, and it turned out that we had to pivot that company as well. And when we pivoted that company and we started to work on managing virtualization in a very different way, more like Google would as a search engine and crawling infrastructure with the software we had written, I kept feeling like I was being sandbagged by one of my engineers. And he took advantage of the fact that I wasn't a Java developer and I didn't really know Java and such. And really, because of what I had taught myself programming, I really didn't know object-oriented programming. I'd never wrapped my head around it. And I remember getting so angry one day from this guy that I said, damn it, I'm going to learn how to code in Java just because I know this guy is deceiving me and I can't take it anymore.
Interesting. Interesting. So to resolve the conflict, you decided to be able to speak the same language so that he couldn't say you couldn't?
That's exactly right. So I went online, I bought several books, and I found this book that rang true to me called Head First Java.
Oh, yeah.
Second edition.
Head First Java, actually written by Kathy Sierra. Kathy Sierra, an amazing writer who actually later wrote a little bit about marketing. And she's written about the humanization of technology and how technologists are failing regular people by making technology too hard and not explainable enough. And most books don't resonate with people and are written for the technology's sake, not the human's sake. She's actually one of my heroes, Kathy Sierra. So it's really interesting to hear that she got you into Java. She actually now raises Icelandic horses in Santa Cruz.
Wow.
So, unfortunately, she's been harassed off Twitter twice for her outspoken views. That's an aside. We'll just put a wrap on that.
And I read the book cover to cover. After I did, I started to understand what was going on, and ultimately, I got rid of him. I was able to, in my view, turn the company down the right path, but in doing so, this was another lesson, I burned up all of my political capital, all of it.
Interesting. How did you know?
Because there were several people that were upset that this guy had left, and I could tell by the way that I was treated by the CEO. that this was kind of that this was
yeah something had turned.
This was the end. Something
you
had
were
turned.
A founder that was a little bit out of control.
I was, and so I decided that it was going to be time for me to leave. In the meantime, I also decided that I was going to dig more into this programming stuff because it was kind of fun and interesting. And at the same time, I decided it was time for me to get involved in social media.
Hey, and Dave, I want to stop you there as you're leaving the company. I think it's so interesting that you were inventor slash computer guy slash ops guy slash hardware guy, but you didn't let that stop you from saying, wait a minute, I can invent stuff. I think so many IT people go, well, I'm just the operator. I just turn switches. I just run stuff. I'm not special, right? I'm not like a programmer who can program. I just do scripts. But it's like, well, no, wait a minute. You're the most valuable person in this whole value chain because you're actually running the stuff and you know where the bottlenecks are and what's useful and what would be good and what sucks. And I think so many people are a little bit scared of taking that leap to like, well, I don't have to be a professional programmer, but I can create stuff even if I am an IT ops, keep the lights on kind of guy. Yeah. I don't know. That's just me pontificating, but I think that that's important.
No, you're right. What I would say is that if you can write a script or a batch file, you have the fundamental ability to do some degree of coding. I ended up working on my own project while I was in the hunt to find my next thing, which would ultimately be Dell, I might add, where I joined Rob Hirschfeld, who was the co-founder of my first company, Protear, at Dell. Rob just recently left Dell, in fact, just I think a month or two ago, and started his own new endeavor called RackN. Up until that point, I decided I was going to not only code more, but get involved with social media. I had seen and worked with another very interesting character, Andrew Kutz. Those of you that know Andrew know that he's the one that kind of got the whole plug-in rage started with vCenter plugins and such.
I laugh. I've never met the man. He seems like an outrageous, fun guy. He basically reverse-engineered the vCenter APIs. And he caused people at VMware to their heads popped off. They were like, what the hell is going on? Anyway, I'll just leave that one there.
Yes, that is indeed the case. I learned from David the value of blogging with the VM blog stuff. What I learned from Andrew was the value of social media. He was involved with Twitter tweeting things, and I saw the level of engagement, and I saw all of these people that he was able to reach out to instantly in real time, and I saw that as this invaluable tool. And so as I decided to start trying to learn more about the world of coding and other things, I noticed that a lot of developers also had Twitter handles, and I decided that maybe I should get on Twitter and try and communicate with people. And so I started to, I did a few tweets and I started to interact with people and I started to learn. That took me down the path of starting to understand social media. So I stuck with the social media stuff and I joined Dell and I started to also write blog posts. As I wrote blog posts and such, that's when I came across a lot of interesting things, including the fact that blogging and tweeting, for example, are a virtuous cycle where if you write a good blog post, you'll end up getting followers on Twitter because of that, and your followers on Twitter will read your blog posts if they follow your tweet stream. So they feed on one another. Which
it's an absolute closed loop.
It is. It is indeed. So I started doing that. I was working at Dell, and I wrote a piece on this idea that I had. I titled the blog post Data Gravity in the Clouds, and it was this phenomenon that I noticed that the more cloud providers would store interesting data and services in their cloud, the more new applications and services would appear. And so it created a virtuous cycle of more data and more services creates more apps and more services, and that the closer you're able to get to that data and to those services, the faster your own service can be. That was the coining of the term data gravity, and that was very popular. It resounded and sounded really good to a large number of people. And because I had already been communicating with the broad number of people in my learnings and in my research, this really got people's attention. And I still continue to research data gravity and information economics, kind of two things that are hobbies of mine. In the meantime, my programming had taken me to learn Ruby. I learned Ruby via JRuby. So I went from Java to JRuby to Ruby, and so I learned to code in Ruby, and I actually really liked it a great deal. So I started to follow some of those Uber coders. One of them was a guy by the name of Ezra Zygmuntowicz. I'd gone to work for VMware. I saw that he checked in this Ruby gem. Think of it as a zip file with some code in it. I saw this and I said, that looks interesting. So I downloaded that Ruby gem. It was publicly available, and he knew when he had checked it in that it was. And I unzipped, or in this case, I unpacked the gem, and I looked at the contents. And in those contents, I found that VMware was working on a platform as a service play. So I wrote a blog post on it. That blog post got the attention of a guy by the name of Jerry Chen. And Jerry reached out to me and started courting me to work for VMware. And ultimately, I went and interviewed, and I was offered a job at VMware, and I joined the Cloud Foundry team. And that's how I ended up working on Cloud Foundry at VMware.
Huh. There's so many layers here. I want to take a step back and think about the different categories in which you could be classified. I could have easily put you in the bucket of the startup entrepreneur. I could put you in the bucket of a programmer or an operations guy. And each one of these times, it wouldn't be the full story. It's interesting because I see a pressure in high tech to specialize in some portion, but you seem to keep evolving. Did you ever feel that pressure, Dave, of feeling like you didn't quite have a home in a company?
Well, I'm sorry, Dave. We can't hire you to be a product manager because you do not have product management experience.
That was perfect voiceover of what I was thinking.
Well, and I have to jump in here and just say one other thing I'm noticing, this trend, because I'm just sitting here smiling of every time somebody tries to shove you into a box, Dave, you just go start a company to solve whatever problem. You're just like, hold on.
I'm going to make a new box. Yeah.
It's either I'm being shoved into a box or I'm bored. It's one of those two things that causes me to go off and say, you know what, I'm going to go do something else. The heck with this.
But what about that pressure? Did you get that sense that in your earlier career, before you were the Dave that people knew, did you feel like, oh man, I'm doing something wrong. People don't know what to do with me?
I did. I absolutely felt that way. The reality is that I remember early on hiring a gentleman that was, I was pretty good with programming switches and routers, but this guy was twice as good as I was, at least. And I remember feeling pressured to become as good or better than him. And then I came to the realization that I can amplify my own skills by hiring people that are better than I am at specific skills.
Ooh, I like that one.
And so I, to this day, hire people that I believe are better than I am at things. And I do it for two reasons. One is it amplifies my own skills because I am not as good as they are, but they're better. And so it allows me to more freely think and focus on other things. And the other is I learn from them. So I get better by hiring people that are better than I am, just as if I found someone to spar with me in fencing or boxing or taekwondo or aikido or judo or what have you, where your skills will go up if your sparring partner's skills are better than yours. Same thing. I've tried to surround myself with people that I believe are better than I am. And I do that to this day. The other thing that I do is I try and be a servant leader. So I try and give my people and serve my people with all of the things that I can so that they can do even better. Because by making them do better, I end up doing even better. It's the whole amplification story once again.
I really appreciate the sort of to go evolutionary psychology on us, like the kind of selfish gene aspect to this, that you're being very candid about like, hey, this benefits me too. Yes, it benefits the company and it benefits the individual. They get the opportunity to shine in their expertise and I'm sure they get value from working with you as well. But just quite candidly, like you benefit from it because it shows that you surround yourself with expertise that complements your own and helps to develop that expertise in yourself.
That's right. But I see it as everyone benefiting. So no one's losing out in the scenario. So I have no qualms about stating what it is and what it is to me as well.
Perfectly straightforward. It makes sense.
And I love the whole I don't know. There's something very open about it too, you know, of just that pay it forward.
Cards on the table.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great story. I'm sitting here really kind of nodding my head and thinking, yes, yes, this all makes a lot of sense. The other thing I'm finding interesting, you sort of look at this cumulative job path, and I think it's inspiring. I hope that our listeners are feeling that same kind of vibe I'm getting, where I am teasing you a little bit of like when, you know, you're bored or you see a problem, you just go fix it. There's something when we talk about framing this episode and saying you don't have to be the loudest person. You didn't shout, oh, this is what's wrong, or I see this. You just went and did it. You just went and invented it. You put your code, your companies, your hires where your mouth was, so to speak.
No, you're right. You're right. That is kind of the path that I've taken. It's proven to serve me well so far. It's interesting in that I gained a great deal from each bit of time that I spent at each of the companies, whether I worked for someone or worked for myself. I still gained a great deal. You know, I ultimately left VMware and went to work for Warner Music Group, which surprised quite a few people. At the time, I went there because, frankly, I was going to prove something else to myself. So I had worked in technology and in marketing. And I had done the CTO thing in my own small startup companies and such. But what I hadn't done was worked as a executive leader in a large company. I had worked in large companies. GE is a gigantic company. I wasn't a leader in GE. I was a frontline doer. So I was offered the opportunity to be the SVP of engineering at Warner Music Group and lead a very large team in building a platform as a service from scratch. So that was interesting to me. So I took that job, and I'll never forget the day I started. I'm still friends with my ex-boss, Jonathan Murray, who's now just a really good friend of mine. I remember going, and I remember starting, and the way the building was laid out, you can imagine a square kind of building with a giant kind of column thing in the center so that the edges, you can't see from one corner diagonally to the other corner. They're kind of cut off from one another. And I remember the original IT team being on one half of the building, and I remember me getting my own quote-unquote corner office all by myself with no one around me. So my whole side is empty. And I remember Jonathan saying, here you are. It's going to be great to watch as you build a team. And I was an army of one. I was expected to find all of the people, hire them, bring them on, architect this platform, which would ultimately become a software factory, and get everyone behind it.
Dave, I'm smiling. We obviously know where it's come to, where like you're respected, you're successful in the industry. So I'm going to ask tough questions because we know how it ends, and it ends very positively. So to frame it, what the hell were you thinking? What gave you the confidence that you would be able to do that at a massive company when you've never done that before in your life? I'm really curious about how you felt about yourself and the role.
I knew that I could do it. I didn't really know, right? But I believed very strongly that I could do it. I understood technically what needed to be done. I knew that it was something achievable. It wasn't something that was, Dave, you need to invent an anti-gravity device and you have 30 days to do it or, you know, the world explodes.
We all fear that job description.
That's right. Yes. Or if you've seen the movie Swordfish, something like that. Nothing like that. It was something that I believed I could do, and it was something that I knew would challenge me, and that later on I would be able to go back and look and say that I learned a great deal from. And that's really part of this whole journey, is learning new things and trying to remain flexible. And remaining flexible means flexible in what you do and how you do it. And that's something that I think gets lost on a lot of people, is the how you do something.
Dig deeper. You've got my ears perked.
Well, it's the idea of a lot of people in IT get used to doing something one specific way, and then because they've always done it that way, are closed to trying a new way. And they say, well, it's always worked this way, so I'm going to keep doing it that way. And or they're not willing to learn something new. That's when they fall into a deficit against someone that's, say, willing to try the new things. And usually, but I'm going to use the word usually, usually
the younger people are more willing to try the new things and do the things than the older people. And that's usually how the younger people break into something that was traditionally done by an older generation. They find a newer, better way to do something, and the older generation sticks with the way they've always done it. And now we're seeing that with businesses themselves, including, by the way, my previous employer. The music industry still hasn't really adjusted to the fact that everything has gone digital and that there's no longer a real business to produce records and such the way there once was, and that it's a different world out there.
A couple things here, just thinking about it from both the practitioner side and the manager side. So your manager self, I can hear you very clearly telling people, be open. If you have a set of skills and you want to leverage your experience, make sure that you combine that with an openness to learning how to do things a new way. If you're a younger person coming into the scene, play up the fact that you're flexible and willing to try new things.
And a new thing for you might be something that's old or original for someone else.
Mm. Do you have any tips or tricks personally? Because I think we all have to fight that urge to go with what's comfortable. Do you have any things that you've tried because you have sort of reinvented in yourself through these different career things? What do you do to kind of keep that muscle sharp?
I usually am at first resistant, like everyone else is. And then when I see a couple of what I consider, I'll call them alphas or leaders in a specific thing, talking or trying something new, that's usually a signal to me that I should go try that and see if I agree with what they're seeing. If I do, then I've learned something. And if I don't, I've also learned something.
Is that one of the ways that you're finding yourself use community now to like identify those alphas?
Absolutely. And I also use the community to test ideas and test my understanding of things. It's perfectly valid to ask questions, to challenge people, to make statements that you think will create discussions or even potentially arguments, as long as they're not like inflaming, horrible, mean things. But if it's questions about technology or relevance of something, you can learn a lot by either being involved in the discussion or watching a discussion between, say, two of those alphas that are already considered experts on that specific topic. It's incredibly valuable.
Well, and maybe I came with a predisposition to thinking this. It's knowing you personally, like I said, it's interesting to me. And I love the story that's coming out of you frame this as these alphas out in the world that you watch. And I think so often people think, like I said, they have to be the one shouting, and people forget about the power of shutting up and listening and all the value that comes from that.
Yeah. And also remember where we started, Amy. I think Dave's first anecdote was how you can't go it alone. So I think we're also, along with the noisiness we're introduced to in the social sphere and influencer sphere, we're also rewarded for being first to something, when in actuality there's a very, very long tail, and there are some people that are just going to be super far along, and that's okay. They're not competition so much as forerunners that can give us a heads up of trends or hack through the bushes for us and lead a little bit of a pathway that we can continue down.
I think you guys are right. I think there are two other things I should mention. One is, because I was involved with all of these things and because I was doing these blog posts and such, and I started to get invited to conferences and things to speak, and I took advantage of that. For a while, it was very difficult for me to get used to even being willing to get on a plane and travel and such. And ultimately, now some people would argue I'm a road warrior in the fact that I will travel for many weeks straight without ever actually returning home. It's not something I recommend doing often, but it does help. The more you go in front, the more you give talks and such, the better you get, again, practicing. And the one other point before I forget that I wanted to state was the other thing that I've learned, and I actually learned this from the third CEO of Hyper9, was that the most valuable leadership skill you can have is transparency with your people. You guys talked about being open and honest, and I call it transparency. The truth is, what I learned was transparency is the other advantage. In other words, avoiding being secretive with your employees. I'm transparent with everyone that works for me. And What I mean by transparent is I'm transparent with what's going on. Even on my personal life side, if I'm sick or if I'm going on holiday or if I'm going somewhere or what have you, I share a great deal. Some people would say I share more than I need to or that I share too much. What I found is that people realize that you're human and that you're understanding and that you're not afraid to tell them what's going on in your life. And so it means that they don't need to be afraid to tell you what's going on in theirs. And it also means that I tell them what's going on with the company. And because of that, it eliminates a lot of the terrible dysfunction that exists inside of a lot of organizations. The rumor mill, so to speak, and all of those things. If you have a transparent organization, you don't have a rumor mill. It disappears.
There's no need for rumors.
Yeah, that's right.
Fascinating, Dave. In fact, you've answered the question that I was going to ask without me asking it, which was about blending personal and work lives. You and your wife are very open. You're on social media. I would say you're very networked at this point. In fact, you're so networked that after you got married recently, you guys dressed up in a tuxedo and a wedding dress and walked around VMworld saying hi to people. So
We did.
Which is, one, funny, and two, you had so many friends, and I think people clapped, and it was actually a lot of fun. But so many times when Amy or Cisco or me at VMware, I'd go and talk to people about this, about being more active, being more social, representing the company and the front lines like this, they'd be like, yeah, you know, it's not for me. I'm a private person. You know, I like to barbecue and stay at home, which is fine. And maybe this is one of these generational shifts. Maybe it's just some people choose to do this or not. But I mean, have you had any other concerns over being so public? I mean, you guys aren't overly, I mean, I don't know every detail of your life. So it's not like you share a lot of personal stuff or, you know, inappropriate stuff, but you guys do share a lot. Are you careful about that? Are you ever conscious? Do you ever write a tweet and go, maybe not?
Yeah, I do self-regulate to a degree. What I try to do is not tweet things that, how would I describe it? I'm careful to only tweet things when I'm awake. If it has not been 5 minutes since I woke up, I'm not going to tweet. If I am intoxicated from drinking alcohol, there is a very small chance that I'm truly going to tweet something because we all do stupid things when we're impaired. And just like I wouldn't get behind the wheel, I'm not going to get behind the keyboard and tweet.
Oh, but that joke seems so funny at the bar, though.
Yeah, right. That's right. I think it's more common sense things. And I do split my life as far as there are things that I'm willing to share on Facebook that I'm not as willing to share on Twitter. Facebook is more of where I would reveal more private things that are going on in my life than on Twitter. But I do share a fair amount on Twitter. That's something that I found that I'm comfortable with. Some people aren't, and I respect that. But there's nothing wrong with you sharing general things. I went and saw this awesome movie. I saw Interstellar. It was great. It's true. I really did. But who can't share that they went and saw a movie and thought it was good? What would you have to fear from that, I guess, would be my point. There's some things that just about anybody could share and you could start a conversation. Certainly movies or some shared interest in something like that is fairly safe to share, especially after the fact. If you're worried about somebody stalking you, there are plenty of topics that are shareable that don't create really any risk, even if somebody's pretty introverted.
Agreed.
Well, and that's some of what I'm really kind of enjoying listening through this is, as you told us your journey, it wasn't like you were out in public right away. This is something you've come into as well. You've created your own rules. You've created your own discipline. And you are extremely networked. And you are very open in saying, you know, hey, like I really like to do these back of the house, super geeky things too. I don't have to be out in front all the time. So you can have that balance and still find a way to use the social channels, engage, et cetera. I like all those kind of lessons that came out of that.
Yeah. And John, I wanted to pass a thought to you as somebody who pays close attention to how people are developing in their careers, especially from sys administration and virtualization into wherever we're headed. Is there anything that you've really synthesized out of this conversation and thought of as good anecdotes that you want to pay forward to people that you consult with?
Well, I know Dave too. We work together, and some of the conversations I've had and gotten value out of already with Dave. But Absolutely. I think that Dave's an interesting type. It's really hard to figure out folks like this. They're a little bit born and a little bit made, and we're all trying to create platforms where people can step up. I've used the analogy of Lewis and Clark before, right? Who not everybody needs to forge a trail where there are no roads. I think some people can drive on the roads, but Dave is interesting that he gets on his four-wheeler and goes. So I think teaching that to people, and some of it's about fearlessness, and some of it's about just blundering forward is important. That was an interesting thought I had this hour. I mean, in terms of consulting and in terms of teaching people how to communicate, you know, we've, Amy and I and you, we've all tried to get people to step up. I think it has to come from inside. I can't take an executive and turn them into a public speaker unless they want to be one. Is that where you're going, Matt? I wasn't quite sure what you were asking.
I'm also going to jump on that a little bit and pick up what Dave said of, you said at first you weren't sure you wanted to go do those things. And I love that part of the quiet advice here too is say yes, give it a try, push yourself, practice, find ways. If people want to change what they're doing, go do it. I love your analogy there, John, of hopping on your four-wheeler and go. Complain less, do more. So much I see of your path in that regard, sort of just going out there and doing it.
Yeah. I like that. And I also like that there's a counter argument to things that you might hear out of an HR department. You're going to hear from HR like, well, give us 7 examples in which you've succeeded at this exact task, and then we'll hire you to do the exact task again at this new organization, because that sounds like a high quality of life and job satisfaction, as opposed to the reality of the world where the most successful, exciting people you're going to meet, many of them are going to be doing whatever they're challenged to do for the very first time. And it's a question of whether you feel confident you can achieve it, whether you have the skills in place to achieve it. And then the execution is something, yeah, it's always going to be new. So accept that you don't have to go in with an army of examples so much as a passion and as much preparation as you can have.
I think that that was a statement, not a question, but I'd agree with it.
Yeah, there's no question there. That was simply a soapbox.
It's our podcast. We can do whatever we want with it.
We're not the quiet types, Dave. You may have known that.
I got a slight hint of it.
We're the geek misnomers.
No whispers. Well, I'm sorry, Dave. I didn't know you were still on the line. I thought John.
Yeah, we were just talking.
Yeah, think about
it. We often actually don't let guests talk, so we've actually been sitting on our hands because actually I found the story fascinating. So,
me too.
Three?
So, Dave, as we wind up with all this stuff going on, where can people find and check in on you? Where can we point them to online and out there in the virtual world?
These days, I'm still actively tweeting. It's simply my last name on Twitter, so it's at MCCRORY. I do have a blog. It's at mccrory.me. I haven't updated it in a long time. I am hoping over the holidays to actually put up some new posts. So my intent is for my blog to come back alive.
Awesome.
Between now and Christmas.
Very cool.
You heard it here first.
Good. Don't give up the ship. Blogging is not dead. It's still valuable.
It is. I agree.
Well, I don't think that was a question, John.
That was a statement. I felt compelled to give a little testimonial, a little message to the listeners.
Quiet. We've been quiet too long. And with that, we will shut up and listen. So, thanks, Dave. Thank you to all our listeners. So as we close out, don't be the quiet types yourself. Send us your questions, your thoughts, your feedback. Give us some thumbs up, likes, stars, share it with a colleague. We love to hear from you, and that's always great fodder for the next round. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Geek Whispers.
You've been listening to the Geek Whisperers podcast, where we bring social media and community to enterprise IT. You can listen to all the episodes at our website, geek-whisperers.com, or check us out on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. Your hosts were John Mark Troyer, Amy Lewis, and Matthew Brender, better known on Twitter as J. Troyer, Comms Ninja, and MJ Brender. See you next week.
It hasn't been updated in a really long time.
So many grammar fails.
Yeah, I totally failed there. I did.